In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast in Little Stevens Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I get to speak with Steve McDonald, the bass player in the long-running Southern California band Red Cross. He formed the band with his older brother Jeff when he was only 11. This was back in 1979. Their latest album, their eighth studio full-length, is a self-titled release and a double album as well. It features our recent coolest song of the world, I'll Take Your Word For It. We'll hear some of that now, and then I'll be back with Steve for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Does it always go that we reap what we sow? Are you my friend? Are you my foe? I don't know. 'Cause every time you're round, I end up on the ground. From words designed to take me down. You don't need to show me.
The Mighty Manfred here in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and my guest today for our coolest conversations is Steve McDonald, bass player in the long-running Southern California rock band Red Cross. Their latest album is titled Red Cross and supplied us with this week's coolest song in the world, I'll Take Your Word For It. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me. Congrats on the new album. This is like your eighth long player, right?
I think technically it's our ninth, but I get confused. There's an EP in there that sometimes people call it an EP or an album.
That EP is also called Red Cross. Is that right?
I've never thought of our first EP as a self-titled record, but it's true. There is one record that doesn't have a title, and it just has our old spelling, R-E-D-C. But now our new spelling, which we've had for 40 years or something, is R-E-D-D-K-R-O-S-S, so two D's and a K. And if you know about it, then you know about it, then you're part of the club.
Well, you and your brother, Jeff, you've been doing the band since you were like in middle school, like 11?
Before middle school, yeah. Like I graduated sixth grade at our first show. Our first show was, our first sort of public performance was an eighth grade graduation party. But I was graduating from sixth grade. It was our drummer that was graduating from eighth grade. And we were, it was a party, and we got Black Flag to play with us too. But then our first sort of real show was 45 years ago, yesterday, which I just realized on stage. And I was, I guess I was 11 or something crazy. Or maybe I'd turned 12 by then.
Wow, so okay, let's back up a little bit more even. So you guys are from Hawthorne, California, right?
Yeah, home of the Beach Boys.
Same time as the Beach Boys, right? Was that ever pointed out to you early on or not?
You can't be in Hawthorne without someone pointing it out to you. It's the Liverpool of the Pacific.
There you go. Hey, so you and your brother Jeff, do you have any other siblings?
Just the two of us.
Just the two of us. So you guys started the band when you're both so young. What got you and your brother into playing music?
I don't know. Punk rock probably convinced us that, you know, we could try it too. You know, garage bands. I mean, the Ramones, the Runaways, those were the groups that we intersected with when we decided, oh, we should probably just do this too.
Well, you were so, man, you're in middle school, but going into high school. What was going on? Like, did your parents play instruments? Was there music in the household? Were you listening to stuff on the radio?
Yeah, no. We weren't hippies on a commune. People always think that, but no, my parents are just nice, normal, you know, suburban people. And, but they had, Jeff and I had some aunts and uncles. They were real rock and roll fanatics. Our Aunt Colleen was 16 in 1965 when she took my brother at 2 years old to the Beatles concert. So Jeff McDonald saw the Beatles when he was two, and he claims he remembers. He said it was alarming, I guess, because it was a complete pandemonium.
You know, what's funny is when I'm interviewing people, talking to people of a certain age, it's, you know, was there ever one moment where you thought this is what I want to do, this sort of have an epiphany? And it's always the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Uh-huh. I mean, it's like if they're of a certain age, I'm just kind of mouthing along on my end, waiting for them to say, oh, there comes Ed Sullivan. He comes up now. And now we're beyond that. So a lot of people I'm talking to, and it's interesting. It's a lot of varied things, but I'm going to put Jeff down for, as I know it wasn't Ed Sullivan, but still he's tied in with the Beatles. That's actually pretty cool.
The Beatles in San Diego in 1965. It was like at a stadium, and it was my grandma and my aunt and my mom and Jeff. And we lived in Los Angeles, but I guess it was easier to get a ticket for the San Diego gig.
Okay, so that was Jeff going to the Beatles concert. What concert did they take you to, this aunt? What concert did they...
Aunt Colleen didn't take me to any concerts. I think Jeff did all the brainwashing by the time I was of age. I was born in 67, so I missed the Beatles touring years. I was around in time for the Summer of Love, and I arrived just before Sgt. Pepper's, and I don't ever remember a time without that record in my life. But the first concert I ever went to, Jeff took me to. I was 8 years old. He was maybe 11 or 12, and it was Kiss at the Forum on their first live album. So I saw their victory lap of, sort of the pinnacle of their live era, in my opinion, at the Forum in February of 1976.
So you play bass, your brother plays guitar. When did... Who's playing an instrument first? Did you play instruments about the same time?
We kind of concocted the plan. We were co-conspirators simultaneously. And for whatever reason, our parents wouldn't buy my older brother a guitar. They thought he was going to squander the opportunity. So he had to get a job, which was for the best. And so he got a job at a fish and chip shop and made just enough money to buy a Stratocaster copy for $40. And I joined the school orchestra in fifth grade because they had a stand-up bass, but they would allow the electric bass in the school orchestra. And so I learned how to play King of the Road on the stand-up bass enough to convince my parents that I wouldn't lose interest in the instrument. And they actually bought me a little Fender Music Master bass for Christmas that year. And that was it. So we plotted and schemed to get instruments. And then once we got instruments, we talked our parents into taking us to a punk rock show at the Whiskey A Go-Go. We saw X and the Avengers in 1978, and they waited in the car across the street. And anyways, so those two things, getting guitars and going to our first punk rock concerts, when we realized that we can do this too. And we started a band within a year. We started writing songs. And, you know, we went from trying to learn other people's songs to just realizing, oh, it's actually kind of easier to make up your own.
and man, your folks, wow.
And supportive. They weren't hippies or, you know, or particularly progressive in other areas, but they knew that, they recognized that we had a real interest in something, and they just, rather than trying to break us of it, they just kind of said, well, this is good that they're into something. And so we're encouraging.
So you and your brother, you've got to have a pretty incredible relationship. I've known guys that have brothers in bands, and sometimes, the personalities work well together, and other times they're just like consistently on the verge of killing each other. And of course, we've got famous stories about the Kinks, et cetera. What's the deal with you and Jeff? I mean, was there ever a moment where he didn't want to be saddled with his little brother in a band? It doesn't seem like that, but
it's weird. I think that he was always very inclusive with me. That whole thing of like, get out of here, kid brother. You're ruining things. I didn't get that with Jeff. He always, I think he viewed me as strength in numbers. And so he always wanted me to go to experience these things with him, which is sometimes it was a little much for me because I was so little. I mean, going to a Kiss concert, it was long before they were a teeny bop band. I mean, a lot of times people think Kiss of like Beth and Christine 16 and, that's for little kids. But in 1976, it was for like the really cool teenagers he was always very inclusive, but then, but the reality is we're human beings and we are siblings. So there's times when it gets, the Dave Davies Gallagher brother effect. Unfortunately, I wish I could say we can always, we've always managed to avoid it, but we're human and, or whatever, all bands. I've been in many different bands and they're all dysfunctional families. So they are definitely, music people who choose to be a musician for life, and then you're going to give them a bunch of responsibilities and then share those responsibilities with other humans that have made that same life choice. It's a recipe for disaster. But, but at the same time, I think that, it's with my brother, it's if I'm going to be in a dysfunctional family anyways, I might as well be in one with a sibling that I have just decades and decades of shared interests and experiences with. And, we wrote this double record together for the most part. And
we're going to talk. We're going to get into the weeds with that in a moment. A couple more questions setting us up here, though. So you form in school. And then already, like in 1980, you put out that first EP on there. It's got Annette's Got the Hits, and I was wondering, you guys must have seen the Beach movies there on maybe local TV.
Oh yeah, well sure, they would show the '60s Beach movies on local TV, like in the afternoon. So we'd come home from school. We were latchkey kids. Both our parents were. Get home from school, and watch Beach movies for sure. And then also soon after Rodney Bingenheimer, we heard his radio show.
Okay.
And we learned that he saw the connection between, Annette Funicello and the Beach Boys and the Ramones. And we didn't, he drew those connections for us.
Right. Did you know Rodney's on the air here in the Underground Garage? Did you know that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know he's been on the air somewhere. So yeah, that's great. Yeah, of course. So he led us back to the garage.
Oh, that is cool. Well, so on the first album on 1982's Born Innocent, you cover Look On Up From the Bottom. That's off the Beyond the Valley of the Dolls soundtrack. So I can see you coming home from school watching the Beach movies on TV, but had you seen Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we were pretty sophisticated kids. I was 14 by the time we made that record. And a fun fact about that is that the video shop where we used to rent videos was called Video Archives. And very famously, Quentin Tarantino worked at that video shop. So he was our video guy. And him and Lance, his boss before them, turned us on to Russ Meyer's films. And we also kind of learned about them from, we were fans of John Waters, and Pink Flamingos would show at midnight at the New Art Cinema in Santa Monica or in West LA. So, we were just always thinking out weird stuff and it didn't take long before we found the films of Russ Meyer. And that movie is this the pinnacle of sort of groovy 60s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, last week I had pulled out, I don't have any organization. Well, some parts of my record collection don't have any organization, but I just, like when I'm cleaning dishes, you know, doing housework, I just kind of go through them just to, see what else is coming up next. And I was listening to that. And familiar, you know, the ones I remember are more Find It and Candyman. And then the Look On Up from the Bottom's on the flip side of the record. And I had totally forgotten about the song. And I was like, oh, yeah, man, this is killer. And then last night as I was prepping, I was like, oh, my God, these guys cover that. And so, yeah, and one more thing about this early time is that, and you mentioned, I can't remember how you phrased it, but you opened up for Black Flag, but was it the, you had one of the guys from Black Flag, I guess, was playing drums, or maybe later on he was a singer in Black Flag, and you also had a guy who was later on the Circle Jerks in one of your early, like the very early lineup?
Yeah, so the first EP, the other self-titled version of our band, when we spelled our name R-E-D-C-R-O-S-S, the lineup was Greg Henson on guitar, who later formed Circle Jerks, and then the drummer was Ron Reyes, who was, I guess, the second singer of Black Flag. We also had Des Cadena in the band at some point. We had many different lineups, and Des was also a singer of Black Flag. He'd sing on the Louie Louie single, and whatever. It was just a little bit of a community for a moment there.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It must have been pretty heady times. I mean, sort of all you guys thinking, hey, let's make some music, let's put out records, let's do something. That must have been pretty great, a great scene at the time.
Well, it was more like Gabba Gabba, hey, we accept you, one of us, Island of Misfit Toys. We were so glad to find our people. And it wasn't this big scene when we first found those guys. Black Flag didn't have a following yet. We opened for them at their very first club shows. The first time we saw them, they were playing at a Moose Lodge, and a veterans hall that they had hired themselves. And when they first started playing in regular nightclubs, like in Hollywood or downtown LA, we were like their little mascot band.
Well, how old were you when you actually played a club the first time, like at some place they were serving alcohol?
Well, it was all ages for some reason. We were like not always. Sometimes they'd kick me out, but I was 12 when Red Cross opened for Black Flag at the Hong Kong Cafe, and but it was all ages. And I had a bunch of 16-year-olds around me that were supposedly looking out for me, and they drove us there or whatever. But and then the Black Flag dudes were older. They were like probably in their early 20s. And, whatever, but people were, no one was babysitting me, but they were also they kept an eye on me a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So the 8th album is out, Red Cross, you know, using that title again, it features our coolest song in the world. I'll take your word for it. Where and when did you record the new album?
We made the new album in, around the holidays of last year. We started in mid-November. And we worked with my friend Josh, and we did it in Los Angeles, and it was a really magical experience. And whatever. Jeff and I got together earlier in the year and started writing songs. I guess we're in 2023, kind of inspired by watching the Beatles Get Back documentary, and just not that we were going to make music exactly like that, although the Beatles imprint is always, it's in our DNA now. But having watched their creative process, it was so demystifying. It was wonderful and so relatable. And it was neat to watch those two guys, John and Paul. Not that I'm comparing ourselves to them, but just this idea that they really valued their creative partnership. And you could see, especially in Paul's face, that he valued John's opinion. And, I think that Jeff and I have our own sort of, little tiny version of that. And I felt grateful that we could get together and write And, you know, at this stage in the game, you know, to have a little bit of wisdom under your belt, to know, you know, to appreciate things in real time. And so whatever, the songwriting just kind of flowed. And then when we went to record, we were just going to do a tight little 12 song record, but then it just kept going so well. So we just kept recording. And then,
yeah, well, I was going to say, double album because you're making up for lost time.
I guess, yeah, maybe so. Or I have this idea that we're at the start of our third act, and so you know.
Well, let's go back to Josh for a minute. You mentioned your friend Josh. We'll talk about Josh Klinghoffer, right, from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. So is he somebody that you knew from back in the day?
I've known Josh for over 20 years. Him and I were both played in Beck's group, you know, Loser and all that. Beck, the great Beck, we toured as I played bass and he was playing guitar on the Sea Change tour back in 2003. So it's over 20 years ago. It was during a period where Red Cross was on hiatus. Jeff and I went on hiatus for 9 years, from 97 to 2006. And during that time, I did a bunch of different things, and one of them was touring as a touring musician for Beck, and then Josh and I also played in Sparks together. You know, the Male Brothers. This town ain't big enough for us, and we've just stayed very close. And yeah, and he's an amazing multi-instrumentalist, and but he had this great studio space, and I just asked him if he would produce our record. We played drums on it, and I asked if he would produce it as well, because our drummer Dale Crover, the great Dale Crover of the Melvins and Red Cross, he was recovering from a back surgery. So, and then Josh is just this crazy jack of all trades.
You know, I'm wondering here, you were mentioning Beck, and so I play in a band, the Woggles, and the one time we had played with Beck was at South by Southwest at Emo's. I think That Dog was also on the bill.
Wow. Okay. That's my wife's band.
Okay. All right. And so were you playing with Beck at that time?
I was not. In fact, I didn't know my wife yet. That was Red Cross Phase Shifter era. But yeah, it's true. Anna Warrenker of That Dog is my wife. And her first tour was with Beck. So yeah, maybe that's... he's come up a few times in my lineage. Also, my brother-in-law, Joey Warrenker, he's played drums for Beck for many years.
I was watching, let's talk some about the Coolest Song. I'll take your word for it. So I watched some of an interview you gave with this Tom Sharpling, and you spoke about people having nostalgia for the 80s, whereas when you were growing up, your nostalgia was for the 60s, and that's kind of come up already as we've spoken, you know, about the Beatles and stuff. Now, this particular song, I'll take your word for it, definitely got a 60s vibe to it. How did the song come together for you?
Oh, I don't know. The song, I just wrote it one day instead of a spurt. The lyric, you know, it's not really about anyone specific, but just kind of the moment. I've had these, you know, where you're feeling a little sensitive, maybe you got dumped or something. And for me, it's either been like an ex, or like maybe a work relationship, a work situation. And then there's a friend that always kind of wants to bring it up, that ex or that band that you're not in anymore or something. And after a while, I just started thinking like, wait, do you just want to watch me squirm? Is that what's going on? Not that I've got a lot of sensitive topics, and luckily I don't really have many of those things, but yeah. So it's just kind of that moment. It's an amalgamation of some people where you start to think like say in the lyric, you know, are you just having fun poking the bear? And, you know, and so it's that kind of moment. But anyways, and then the tune was just really like, I put a capo on the third fret for the musician types. It's like a bar that you place over your guitar neck, and it's picked to make things a little bit more jangly. Like, for instance, like Here Comes the Sun has got a capo up on the seventh fret, and that's super jangly. And those are just the chords that came out. I had this lyric idea, and that's where my muse took me. So I also like the idea of like a song that's kind of has a sweet, pretty melody, but a little bit of a cut, a little bite to the lyric. So a fun combination.
Well, so you mentioned you and your brother, I guess, before the beginning of the year, I guess beginning of 2023, you're watching the Beatles documentary, and kind of inspired you guys to write. And on the album, as you mentioned, there's songs that you've written, the songs your brother's written, and a bunch of songs that are credited to both. Are you guys, so obviously you're writing independently of each other, but when these things are co-written, is that ever sitting down together to write a song? Or is it more like somebody has an idea, comes to the other brother, and, you know, I'm kind of stuck with this, let me know what you think? Or what is that? The relationship, the writing relationship.
It's all different ways. But one thing that's kind of new is I never used to really finish songs on my own. So that's one thing that's a little different on this record, that I finished 5 songs on my own. As far as the collaboration, a lot of times it'll be like one of us has a riff, and then we just kind of a lyric comes out of some sort of topic that we just are gassing on. Or sometimes it just comes in the moment in real time, just like watching that Beatles documentary when you see Get Back, the song, come out of Paul spontaneously. And so some of the songs on the record were just kind of, you know, completely birthed entirely with each other in the room. But probably more what's common is that someone will start something and the other will help them finish it. And it's just fun because, like, you know, we get to cheerlead each other through it. And I think that there's a trust in each other's, taste and sensibility that's rare and to have in another human being. You know, I mean, I like to try to collaborate with all sorts of people, but there's something so special about someone that you saw Kiss with in 1976.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple more songs I wanted to ask you about. You collaborated on the tune Back of a Cave. Who's the bigger Neanderthal fan, the bigger caveman fan?
Back of the Cave. That's great they're asking me about that tune. So, yes, that song that came from, I kind of thought of that as like archaeology, that particular track, because it had some melodies and some riffs, but they were on tapes that were really old, and he brought them to me. And that was an interesting collaboration because I had the idea about a kink style tune, since the Village Green Preservation Society, about basically wanting to check out and just you wanting to live in the back of the cave. And I had this, you know, oh, for the life in the back of the cave, you know, and that was my idea. And Jeff had these melodies and these chords, and I gave him the assignment, and I said, what I basically just described to you. And he liked the idea, and he sent off running with it. I mean, the second verse is where he starts to talk about how you don't have to live in the back of the cave. And that was always kind of annoyed me because I liked the idea of him singing about how he only wanted to live in the back of the cave. But that's the partnership. That's the collaboration. It's like, it comes out how it comes out. And the idea that I sold him this idea for a song and it inspired him to like just start writing is unique, and I love that. And so that's how that one happened.
Well, you got a song on there, Stuff, where you lament having too much. So Steve, I want to ask you honestly, do we need an intervention? Are you a hoarder?
My wife is really annoyed with those lyrics. She's like, because they say can't even sit down, or something, got too much stuff, it's way more than enough, it's piling up all around, can't even sit down. We're not hoarders, but we do kind of have like Monica's closet, like on the Friends show. Like there's certain areas, you know, like there's, maybe you don't want to open that one closet door, but it's actually a storage area, which I'm in charge of, and it drives me crazy. But no, I mean, the other thing is that it's like, whatever. It's like, we all like collecting things, and, you know.
Well, what do you like collecting?
Well, my weakness is guitars. And that's the thing with my guitar collection, our basses, you know, But I'm always like, but it has a practical use.
How many guitars, six strings, four strings, do you have?
I don't know. I mean, I've had, I've never really kind of corralled them and counted, but I've sold very few. And I've been collecting basses since I was 12. So yeah, I don't know, more than a dozen basses probably. And nowadays I've gotten really bad because the sort of cheaper instruments now are made much better than they used to be. And I like to be color coordinated. So I might even buy an instrument just because the color matches my suit.
Well, look, it's putting on a show, man. I think that's great. That sounds good to me. I'm down with you. I won't dissuade you. I won't dissuade you.
But we don't need an intervention. My wife wants everybody to know we're not hoarders.
So the we have time, I'll ask you for a couple more songs. Then so the track "Terrible Man," is that about this I read online that "Terrible Man" is about musicians as cult leaders.
Well, "Terrible Band." Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, yeah, there's a few. Well, but there's a lyric in there, "Terrible Man," or, you know, "Unbearable Man" and "The Terrible Band." Yeah. I mean, I think that that's definitely a Jeff lyric. And yeah. And well, Jeff and Josh were watching lots of documentaries about cults while we were making them, and like Father Yod and the Source Family. I was always in the other room, like not pulling my hair out, but like digging deep arrangements. And I'd walk in there and those two were, you know, and they had some new cult documentary to show me. But, you know, I think there's also just something about the rock star as cult leader that's interesting too. But then there sometimes are literal, there's been literal cults in history where they had a terrible band to go along with that cult.
Well, now the album ends with a track "Born Innocent," and I think that's also the title to the first album, not the EP, but the first album. That song is about you guys. Is that correct? About you guys starting off, forming the band.
Well, it's also the closing credit theme for a documentary that was finished this year called "Born Innocent," and yeah, it's named after our first album, which is sort of named after a Linda Blair TV movie from the 70s called "Born Innocent."
Oh, right. Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
About juvenile delinquency. But it's sort of like our Creek Alley, you know, it's like our origin story song. And the director of the film, Andrew Wright, sort of challenged us with this idea. He needed a closing credit song. And he said, "Will you do an origin story song?" And and so that's what we came up with. And Jeff and I both kind of take on a verse. It's sort of sung in duet form. And we both sort of tell our story about getting our first instruments and what happened in that time.
So really, we didn't even need to talk. Could have just played the song and read the lyrics or something like that. But I'm glad we are talking. So you've been out on tour the last couple of weeks. It's the Friday, the 2nd. You're going to play tonight in Nashville, Tennessee. You're playing at the Blue Room at Third Man Records. I've been to like Third Man in Detroit, the store, and they've got like a stage in the store. Is it a similar thing in Nashville? Do you know?
Yeah, there's there is a shop in Nashville, but I think it's a little smaller than the one in Detroit. It's more like a cool, groovy little boutique. But then there's a big old warehouse. It's a big operation in Nashville. And well, I guess it is in Detroit too. And then the Blue Room is more of a venue in the back, and also a space where they maybe like would film videos and stuff. And we played it once about 10 years ago. It's a cool space. It's great. I like Nashville, and it's a great thing that the Third Man set up shop there.
Oh, love it as Nashville as well. So the typical thing it seemed like they would do is the bands would play there in the place in Nashville and they record them, and then they put out like live records recordings on third band. Are they going to do that with your show?
I don't know. I should ask them in advance. Yeah, I remember they had like all this crazy stuff set up to like, you know, live to acetate, you know, 1959 technology, you know, really cool stuff. I don't know if they've got it set up for this time. I'd be cool with even some Pro Tools recordings of it's there, but I'll have to ask. That would be cool.
Well, tomorrow you're at the Saturn in Birmingham, Alabama, the Earl on Sunday in Atlanta, both really cool places. Is there any play, because you're doing a lot of shows between the States and overseas, you know, between now all the way into the fall. Is there any place that you've been or that you're going to play that you haven't done before this tour that you're really looking forward to?
Well, the whole European tour that we have coming up, I mean, I love playing the States and, you know, all the, but I think every stop on this particular tour we've done before. But in Europe coming up in the fall, there's a lot of stuff we haven't been to or haven't been to in like decades. I think we're playing some groovy sort of 60s psych rock festival in Benidorm, Spain, that I hear is great. I forget what it's called. Vampire Weekend or something, I forget. But that's going to be cool. I've got the name wrong. It's not Vampire. That's a band. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just, doing it with Red Cross is just really exciting for me to play anywhere. And you mentioned that we'll be in Atlanta. I really love playing the Earl.
Oh, so let me, so this is what I'm getting at too, though. So there's a lot of dates. I like myself, I like a lot going out on the road, but, you know, I'm like maybe 2 years older than yourself. So 65 is when I was born. So so you enjoy playing, traveling, being out on the road, or is this something you like, but it's really a chore? How do you sit on that, fall on that?
Once the machine is up and rolling and firing on all cylinders, it is a privilege that I am grateful for in real time. But yeah, sure. There are times when it's like, when it's stressful and I'm away from home, but like any job, you know, and so any job can become stressful and taxing, but, yeah, no, I mean, it's neat for me. I'm like a working class kid from Hawthorne, California. We were airport rats is what we used to say, because we grew up so close to LAX. And we would actually go there just to like goof off in the summertime and before all the security measures. And we just walk around in shorts and barefoot at LA at the airport. But we never got to fly anywhere. My family didn't do that. So I would just see planes take off to these magical mystery places. And that was for someone else. And so maybe that's part of it for me. Like the fact that I get to go to these exotic places around the world and play music, it's never has never lost its allure for me. And, you know, and maybe I'm not Dave Grohl, but it still feels like a gigantic success to me.
Right now we can play one more track from the album, and I'd like us to go out with Stunt Queen. I read that your brother had said that this was the closest you've come to writing a political song. Does that sit right with you? Is that correct?
Well, Jeff wrote many of the lyrics in the song, so we'll have to go with his interpretation. My memory of it was that he was talking more about a specific friend of ours who likes to just be a provocateur on social media. But that same mentality extends into the political landscape, too. And yeah, Jeff has always steered away from making political statements, so I guess he must really... have an axe to grind right now, which I think many do.
Steve, let's give that tune a listen. But first, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Yeah, it was really fun. Thanks for having me.
Well, right now, here's Red Cross off the new album, Red Cross, with Stunt Queen and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Yeah.
some of Stunt Queen. That's Red Cross here in Little Steven's Underground Garage off their new eponymous double album. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the bass player, Steve McDonald, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing and Kurt Baker for editing. Guitar slinger and singer-songwriter Ryan Ray is a favorite of ours here in the Underground Garage. He's on Wicked Cool Records, and he's got a new album out now called My Town. He'll join us next time around to tell us all about it. That's Brian Ray on our next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I said, yeah.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.